Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Freaky Geek. If this is your first time joining us, please go ahead and give us a like on Facebook so that we can keep you up to date with what's going on, our upcoming episodes, all sorts of weird, freaky, geeky stuff throughout the world. It's a good time. I'm going to tell you, it's a good time. Christopher is actually on his way to me to Texas. Thank God. Finally, this hellstorm is about to be over. And I am always joined by my gruesome gal pals, Carrie and Stacy.
Hey, hey.
Hey, guys.
So tonight we are getting into the New England Vampire Panic. We got it just in time for Halloween. We're right here with you guys, and we will do that right after the jump. All right, we are back, everyone. Welcome to Freaks and Geeks. As I said, we're going to talk about the vampire panic of the 19th century. Just in time for Halloween, taking a little Halloween tour of some of the creepier, geeky topics. But before we get into it, I really kind of want to stop for a second, and I want to say that I really appreciate my co-host here. I really appreciate you guys being on with me. I know that life is crazy and that we're all moms, and we're all like, you know, we all have a ton of things going on in our lives, and I really appreciate you guys being here.
Aww.
I'm happy to be here.
I think that we're awesome.
This is great.
Yeah, it's the best part of my week, so, I mean, I'm not even lying. Anywho. So nearly 200 years after the Salem witch trials, little throwback to last week, people became convinced that their deceased loved ones were returning from the grave to feed upon the living. New England vampire history and hysteria kicked off a full century after the region's better-remembered witch trials, and although Rhode Island was seemingly the epicenter, it was a region-wide phenomenon. The New England vampire plague that started in the 1790s built upon earlier outbreaks in Europe. As communities grasped for explanations of infectious diseases before such illnesses were scientifically understood. In early New England, In early New England, the disease that we now know as tuberculosis was commonly called consumption. The classic symptoms are a chronic, sometimes bloody cough, along with fever and weight loss. To helpless loved ones, it appeared as though the victim was withering away, aka being consumed. So fun fact here, though, tuberculosis was also considered a beautiful death. That's kind of the Victorian era thinking, is because you would expire with like one single droplet of blood around your mouth. And sometimes in practice, in reality, it wasn't quite so pretty, but there were people that would die, young people especially, and their corpses would look, dare I say, beautiful. So it was considered to be something that was, you know, a terrible thing. It was something that affected a lot of people, obviously, during that time frame, but it was this mysterious thing. You didn't quite see as much decay. And so I think a lot of that actually contributed to the consumption being attributed to vampirism, but we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Well, wait a second. Wasn't it Doc Holliday in Tombstone that supposedly died of consumption, a very hot Val Kilmer?
Yes.
Didn't he
yeah,
have? Okay. So, yeah, Val Kilmer, sort of Tombstone Val Kilmer, not Val Kilmer now. I think he's probably, I think he doesn't look as good as he did in the past, I don't think.
No.
But, yeah, a Val Kilmer, Tombstone era Val Kilmer vampire. Yeah, that's pretty hot.
Yeah, I would take that. I would definitely take that as one of the, you know, versions of, you know, Interview with a Vampire. I wouldn't mind maybe Interview with a Cowboy Vampire. I don't know. I mean, that could be.
Oh, yeah.
A million.
I mean, I can just hear it.
Yeah.
I'm your Huckleberry.
Yeah. You're a Daisy if you do.
Damn straight.
Doc Holliday, he did suffer from consumption. Big Nose Kate, who was his accomplice through much of that film, she also died of consumption. Like, there were a lot of people that basically would head west because of the climate out west that was thought to kind of dissuade the marching symptoms of consumption that a lot of people were suffering from.
My great-great-grandfather moved his entire family from Kentucky to Texas try to get a better environment for his, yeah.
So really? Funny. Your great-great-grandfather had tuberculosis?
Yeah.
Wow. Does it say, like, consumption on his death certificate, or does it say tuberculosis?
So he lived at an opportune time. And they moved to Texas around 1900, and then they moved back and actually moved to McKinney, Virginia in the 20s, and it just ended up dying of old age, actually, because eventually, you know, an antibiotic was invented that could treat it. So he survived long enough to be cured.
Wow, that's a really cool story.
Oh, thanks.
That's really
so neat. I was just talking to one of the contractors that's working on my house, and he was the coolest old dude. Like, he was awesome. I highly recommend him. If anybody's getting painting their house in the Hampton Roads area, let me know, because I'll tell you all about how awesome he is. Anyway, awesome, really old dude, but talking to him, you're going to get a story, and it's going to take a couple hours. And so when he found out that I was in Texas, and unfortunately the day that we met, I had a migraine, he was like, oh, well, you won't have those anymore. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, what? He's like, yeah, well, you're moving to Texas. The climate out there is better for almost everything. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, I haven't felt a big difference yet, but I'm hoping that just like consumption, this climate will be better for my migraines as well. So it makes him, it made me think of the consumption argument, because as soon as he said that, he's like, oh yeah, you're going out west, you won't have any of those problems anymore. Like, oh, is this the deal? Is this the new, like, Oregon Trail? Are we all heading out because of the vapor? You know? But here we are. So I guess I'll let you guys know if it's better.
Well, I think if it's...
That sounds like a plan.
Like, caused by the weather, it could definitely help.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dry climate is definitely a lot better if you're dealing with, I would think, anything in the lungs or anything like that. I mean, all you have to do is be sick in Hampton Roads when it's 100 degrees outside with, you know, 80% humidity, and you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Humidity is disgusting.
Yeah, it's like soup in there. It's not as bad as Georgia. Georgia was way worse, but it's bad. Anyway,
let's picture ourselves in New England.
Yes, let's picture ourselves in New England, in the Victorian era. People are dropping like flies because of the consumption. The classic symptoms of consumption are a chronic, sometimes bloody cough, along with fever and weight loss. To helpless loved ones, it appears the victim was withering away, I already said that, or being consumed, which is where how we get the name consumption. Without medicine to slow its spread, TB was a devastating affliction. By the dawn of the 19th century, it was responsible for approximately one out of every four deaths in the eastern U.S. Like I said, people dropping like flies. To this day, tuberculosis is the world's most deadly infectious disease, responsible for well over a million deaths each year.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Based on what they were seeing, and a good dose of superstition, of course, many early New Englanders believed that vampires, not the disease, were responsible for the symptoms. Of course, not everyone bought into the superstition. In June of 1784, a letter to the editor of the Connecticut Current and Weekly Intelligencer from a Willington town councilman cautioned readers against being misled by a quack doctor who encouraged families to dig up and burn dead relatives to stop consumption from spreading. Legend being that the surest way to stop a vampire was to burn its vital organs. One of the earliest known cases of New England vampirism to have a name attached to it was that of Rachel Harris, who died of tuberculosis in 1790. The year after her death, her widower, Captain Isaac Burton, married her stepsister, Hulda. Not Hilda. Hulda.
I love it.
Hulda began exhibiting symptoms similar to Rachel's, and family and friends therefore reasoned that Rachel was the culprit. In February of 1793, more than 500 Manchester residents braved frigid temperatures to watch the liver, heart, and lungs be removed from Rachel's exhumed corpse burned on a blacksmith's forge. According to some versions of the tale, portions of the organs were preserved to make a medicine for Hulda. Regardless, she died that September. Following her death, did the good people of Manchester realize the error of their ways? Well, sort of. The reason that perhaps Rachel hadn't been a vampire at all, or rather a witch.
Oh, Lord.
Can't figure it out. It's always witches.
Okay, so question.
Sure.
If you're going to exhume a diseased corpse, okay, what are the chances that you're going to actually spread more disease, vice, stop it basically from spreading?
Oh, 100% you're going to spread more disease.
Oh, yeah.
So they're doing this in a way to stop whatever's happening from happening. And in doing so, they're actually probably making the situation worse.
Oh,
yeah.
Definitely. I mean, the family members that are affected already had it before the person died. They already had it. They might not have been exhibiting symptoms. They may have been exhibiting symptoms. They already were infected. But then you're digging up the corpse and burning organs and, you know, maybe making somebody eat it or drink it or consume it in some way. It
course it was spreading.
Well, and you know, back then they probably didn't have, like, you know, it's not like now with, like, hand washing and hand sanitizer. So
I want to be clear, though, that tuberculosis was only spread through the air. You can't get it from, like, kissing someone or hugging someone. So I would assume, I mean, there's not a whole lot of information about this. I just looked it up. But, like, I would assume that you would not automatically get it from using a dead diseased person in your concoction. However, I would just say that generally that's a really shit idea, so probably don't do that.
I don't plan on digging up diseased bodies anytime soon.
Yeah, well, you know.
But just in case I get a bug in my ass to do so, I will remember this, and I won't.
But just, it's a bad idea in general. But you're safe with tuberculosis, because that's the name of it.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, then I won't die a beautiful Victorian death.
You never know. I mean, don't say never.
So, it is possible to become infected with tuberculosis from a corpse. There was a case of an embalmer in the United Kingdom who was infected when the TB was transmitted from a corpse that he was working on.
It makes me wonder if he was somehow exposed to air that was preserved in the lungs of the body or in some of the the areas of the body that hold air after a person dies. Because, like, the chest cavity in and of itself just kind of becomes a balloon. There's gases and all sorts of things that fill up in there, and I'm sure that there's some sort of leakage of air. So I wonder if that was it.
Well, and depending on how – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was – okay. So I was going to say, depending on how they were buried, so if you think about it, if you have, like, some sort of a tomb or something that's stone that's really kind of airtight, I mean, I'm assuming that if they're trying to spread disease and maybe even possibly somebody coming back from the dead, I mean, they're, you know, putting them in some sort of situation, the body in a situation where there's not a lot of airflow. So when you start to bring these dead bodies and open up the, you know, sarcophagus or whatever that they're entombed inside, you would think that off-gassing, you know, of the body is actually building up inside that little space. So as soon as you open that, disease.
One of the main organs that they would remove would be the heart, which they would go through the chest cavity to get to. And the World Health Organization says that tuberculosis can be acquired if the bacillus is aerosolized. Residual air in the lungs is exhaled. Fluid from the lungs squirted up through the nose or mouth during handling of the corpse. And quite a few of these happened in the colder months of the year, so the bodies didn't really start decomposing.
Yeah.
When did they start embalming?
Well, they actually
during
started
his
it.
Story.
Yes.
I beat you, Carrie.
And how about I didn't hear either one of you because you both talked at the same time.
Well, it was during the Civil War, and it was because families would send their loved ones away to war, and, you know, sometimes people would die, and then their families would want to see their loved one last time, and unfortunately there was no method for people to be able to do that. So they took a lot of different methods from around the world, including ancient Egypt, and they basically designed preservative methods for bodies, and then they would ship them away to wherever their relatives were on trains. There's a whole, like, evolution to it. There's all sorts of different proprietary chemicals, and each person that slept embalming had kind of a different concoction. Some people would fill the body cavities with sawdust, and some people would just use really strong antibiotics. And there's all sorts of different preservative measures during the Civil War because people were just kind of like, yeah, this will do it. you know, this is a strong chemical preservative. It'll do anything. And it was kind of a lot of trial and error. So.
Yeah. So yep. I'm just thinking about those sort of methods that you're talking about and how that could impact also the spread, you know, if you're digging up a dead body.
Well, in theory, you wouldn't embalm after someone was already buried.
Like, no, I understand. No, what I'm saying is if you embalm them before they're buried and then you go and dig them up, if my heart and liver and lungs are filled with sawdust, then there's no air to be coming out.
Right. These so, people probably weren't supposed to get embalmed.
Right.
Yeah.
This was all like really rural areas that didn't have a lot of population, and people were just being buried either on the farm or in a churchyard within a couple of, you know, a day or two of passing away. So they
gotcha.
Weren't being embalmed.
Okay. All right. Well, in February 1796, the Cumberland Town Council granted permission for Stephen Staples to exhume the body of his 23-year-old daughter, Abigail, who had died of consumption. Shortly after Abigail's death, her sister, Lavinia, had started showing familiar symptoms of consumption. Lavinia told of dreams in which a shadowy figure sat heavily on her chest and drew out her breath. During one of those dreams, she reportedly called out Abigail's name. The town officials consented that Staples could try an experiment to save Lavinia's life, despite noting the decision was made, quote, against the better conscience of this council. So there's no record of what came of the exhumation, or for that matter, of Lavinia. In his journal entry in September 26, 1859, Henry David Thoreau noted, quote, the savage in man is never quite eradicated. I have just read of a family in Vermont who several of its members having died of consumption just burned the lungs and heart and liver of the last deceased in order to prevent any more from having it. Now, at this time, Thoreau himself had long been battling tuberculosis, so he would have been, I guess, familiar with why they were doing these things. Of which he would die of 3 years later, although in this case, no one seems to have suspected vampire involvement for Henry David Thoreau. As for the episode to which Thoreau referred, it's likely the 1790s ordeal of the Spalding family. They lost six of 11 adult children to consumption. Lieutenant Leonard Spalding was desperate, as I think anybody would be if you lost six of 11 of your adult children to consumption. When yet another daughter grew ill, the body of the most recently deceased child was dug up and the vital organs removed and burned. Incidentally, one vampire adjacent belief of the day was that vines would grow between buried caskets, and that once all the burials in a plot had been so connected, another family member would die. So when Spalding's son Reuben was buried in 1794, his grave was set apart from those of his other family members, possibly to break the chain. Well, that's really interesting.
Gotta love Victorian times.
Yeah, that's just insane.
I wonder if it worked.
Carrie. Yeah. Well, I don't know. We'll have to see. Sarah Tillinghast was the first of Snuffy Tillinghast's 14 children to die. When his surviving children claimed that Sarah continued to visit them at night, it might have seemed part of the natural grieving process. But by 1799, five more Tillinghast children had died of consumption and another was gravely ill. When the bodies of the dead were exhumed, all except Sarah were found to be in advanced stages of decomposition. Her heart was removed and burned in front of the family home. Describing the episode decades later, in 1888, writer Sidney Rider observed, "Peace then came to this afflicted family, but not, however, until a seventh victim had been demanded." After Nancy Young died at 19, 1827, her sister commenced a rapid decline in health with sure indications that she must soon follow Nancy to the grave, obviously. When Nancy's other siblings began to decline, their father, Captain Levi Young, asked his neighbors and friends to exhume and burn her remains while all the members of the family gathered around and inhaled the smoke from the burning remains. This cure apparently did not work. 5 more children died.
Yeah, I should think not. I mean, geez. Like, really?
Hey, Victorian times, man.
It's like, of course you know that the rate of children dying back then was just out of control. You'd be lucky if half of your kids made it to adulthood. But
yeah,
they had to think,
I know.
Well, they had to think, like, okay, you know what? These ones made it to adulthood. We're good. And then just have, in some cases, whole families wiped out. Or if you were one of the people that was, I guess, immune maybe to it, or, you know, you didn't contract it, or whatever the case may be, you didn't die from it. Like, I can't imagine how that would feel.
Yeah, I can't imagine what life was like at this period of time. I mean, and I'm like a complete germaphobe. So, like, just reading about these things, oh, and a hypochondriac, by the way, to boot. So, like, just reading these things, I'm absolutely horrified by this. Like, seriously, like, if somebody wanted me to inhale the smoke of somebody's burning remains, I'd be like, yeah, no, sorry, peace out. I'm not doing this.
I'm just picturing you right now with, like, a can of Lysol in one hand and, like, a massive, like, industrial-sized bottle of Purell in the other.
I ain't even fucking kidding. You can ask April. She'll tell you. She knows.
She's not kidding.
No, just... Full Howie Mandel, huh?
For real.
but then again, as I always say to April, my house is so dirty. Oh my God, my house is so dirty.
We know it. A little bit of dirt is good.
It's like immaculate.
I have a problem. Well, more than one, but that's just one of them.
that's another episode. Just do a whole episode on our various eccentricities.
Yes.
Okay. So in 1845, 24-year-old Lemuel Ray died of consumption at the age of 24. His death was followed by that of his father a few years later, and then his brother. 3 years after that, when Lim's oldest brother, Henry, fell ill, the family took drastic measures, exhuming and burning. Henry died despite their efforts. Interestingly, an accidental discovery in the 1990s suggested that perhaps the Rays were not the region's first vampires. Just a few miles away from Ray's farm, some kids discovered a skull. Further investigation revealed an unmarked graveyard where 29 bodies were buried. Archaeologists determined that one of the bodies, which showed signs of tuberculosis, had been dug up and reburied with the head removed and turned face down, and the femur bones arranged on the chest in the shape of a cross formation, kind of like a Jolly Roger. The only marking on the grave was the initials JB. In Exeter, Rhode Island, deserted Exeter, as it was called, was one of the border towns, mostly comprised of subsistence farmers trying to make a living out of the difficult soil. The farmers removed what stones they could, piling them into ramshackle walls. They planted their rows of crops around the boulders that were too big to move. The changing landscape at the end of the 1800s took a toll on the community. Casualties during the Civil War, new railroads, and the exodus westward led to abandoned farms. By 1892, the population had dropped to below 1,000 people, less than half of what it had been just 70 years earlier.
So one resident, Mercy Brown, was born in Exeter in 1872. Her family consisted of her father, George, her mother, Mary Eliza, sister Mary Olive, and brother Edwin. The Brown family lived on the eastern side of town, farming 40 acres when tragedy struck. Mercy's mother, Mary Eliza, succumbed to tuberculosis in December of 1882. Mercy was 10 years old. The next year, Mercy's sister, Mary Olive, died of the same disease at the age of 20. Mary Olive's obituary gives a window into the painful end she suffered. Quote, the last few hours she lived was of great suffering, yet her faith was firm and she was ready for the change. Within a few years of the loss of their mother and sister, Mercy's brother Edwin, described as a burly sort of fellow, became ill and headed became ill and headed west to Colorado Springs in hopes that the change in climate would cure him, kind of like April. After his departure, and nearly a decade after her mother and sister's deaths, Mercy began exhibiting the symptoms of consumption. Her tuberculosis was the type called galloping. She was likely infected as a child, remained asymptomatic for years, and then quickly declined after her symptoms began. So it sounds like maybe, I guess, a long incubation period for whatever virus, bacteria. A doctor who attended her was said to tell her father that further medical aid was useless.
Which is not that bad. It's
before Mercy succumbed to her illness in January of 1892, Edwin returned from Colorado. He was dying. After Mercy's passing, neighbors of the Browns, likely concerned for their own well-being, approached the patriarch of the family, George, offering an alternative theory. Perhaps one of the three Brown women wasn't dead after all, but instead was feasting on the living tissue and blood of Edwin. If the perpetrator was discovered and destroyed, Edwin could recover. George granted the neighbors permission to examine the bodies of his wife and daughters in order to check for fresh blood in their homes, a sure sign of a vampire. Early on March 17, 1892, a group of men, along with a doctor and newspaper correspondent, dug up the corpses. After nearly a decade, Lena's sister and mother were barely more than bones. Lena, though, had been dead only a few months, and it was winter time. The body was in a fairly well-preserved state. The correspondent later wrote, the heart and liver were removed, and in cutting open the heart, clotted and decomposed blood was found. During this impromptu autopsy, the doctor again emphasized that Lena's lungs showed diffuse tuberculosis germs. Undeterred, the villagers burned her heart and liver on a nearby rock, feeding Edwin the ashes. He died less than 2 months later.
That is so gross.
Om nom 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 nom.
That's so gross.
Interesting follow-up to this is George, the father, ever showed any symptoms of tuberculosis, and he actually lived into the 1920s. So I guess it's a good thing he let his neighbors dig up who they wanted to give up, since he had to deal with them for, you know, nearly 30 more years. So one 1896 New York World clipping of even found its way into the papers of a London stage manager and aspiring novelist named Bram Stoker. The theater company was touring the United States that same year. The Gothicula was published in 1897. Some scholars have said that there was not enough time for the news accounts to have influenced the Dracula manuscript, yet others see Lena in the character of Lucy. Her very name is a tempting amalgam of Lena and Mercy. A consumptive-seeming teenage girl turned into a vampire who is exhumed in one of the novel's most memorable scenes. Fascinatingly, a medical doctor presides over Lucy's disinterment, just as one oversaw Lena's. Whether or not Lucy's roots are in Rhode Island, Lena's historic exhumation is referenced in H.P. Lovecraft's The Shunned House, a short story about a man being haunted, dead relatives, that include a living character also named Mercy.
Those scholars today still struggle to fully explain the vampire panics. A key detail unites them, and that is this public hysteria always occurred in the midst of a tuberculosis outbreak. So I think a lot of this, I mean, just going by what we're talking about tonight, it sounds like there's just not a lot of medical understanding of what's going on. And of course, you know, when there's a lack of understanding comes fear. So that's just kind of where I'm kind of at with this. Typically, a royal family contracted the wasting illness, and even though they often received the standard medical diagnosis, the survivors blamed early victims as vampires responsible for preying upon family members who subsequently fell sick. Often, an exhumation was called for to stop the vampires' predations. Why do I feel like Chris right now?
No, you're pretty. It's predations.
The particulars of the vampire exhumations, though, vary widely. In many cases, only family and neighbors participated. But sometimes town fathers voted on the matter, or medical doctors and clergymen gave their blessings or even pitched in. Some communities in Maine and Plymouth, Massachusetts, opted to simply flip the exhumed vampire face down in the grave and leave it at that. Okay. I'm thinking if somebody's a vampire and they're wanting to get out, just flipping them face down isn't going to do anything to stop that, but okay. In Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Vermont, though, they frequently burn the dead person's heart, sometimes inhaling the smoke as a cure. In Europe, too, exhumation protocol varied within the regions. Some beheaded suspected vampire corpses, while others bound their feet with thorns. So, I mean, this kind of goes to also the one that we had, that I posted online, that Chris and I were talking about when he was here before he left to head down to Texas, was that skeleton they found buried, and they found a rock in its mouth. So I guess that's another way.
Yeah, that is really popular in, like, Eastern Europe, which it's, I mean, a lot of the immigrants in this area kind of came from that region, from Germany, in a couple different ways, starting, you know, pre-revolution, during the revolution with the Hessians, which some Hessians came and just stayed, and then later immigrants kind of all come to this region bringing those same kind of stories.
I don't know what you said, Carrie, because I can't hear you, but I wanted to say that the corpse that was found with the rock in its mouth in Europe, which I think is something you were talking about, Carrie, the corpse with the rock in its mouth is actually not that abnormal in Eastern Europe. In fact, in Romania, there is a tradition of something called a strigoi. And strigoi is essentially a vampire. It could be a witch in some cases, but the strigoi goes out, and they have cases from, you know, recent times where there has been a person who has died, and they have suspected this person of being a strigoi, and the family of victims have gone out to the gravesite and actually staked the person down and exhumed the body and basically and cut the head off in many times. So there's actually still people today that go through and do things like putting a rock in, you know, a corpse's mouth to think that they can stop the vampirism.
So here's the thing that I'm struggling with all this. So when I think about vampires, you know, I'm thinking about it in sort of the, you know, for lack of a better term, like the sexy way. And because, I mean, that's what we kind of have right now, thanks to things like, you know, the Twilight series and things like that. And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of different, you know, books and everything that have come out, different series that are, you know, vampire related that probably are not so much horror stories as much as they are whore, W-H-O-R-E stories. But so I'm thinking back to this time in this whole vampire panic, and really it's based on disease, not necessarily some, you know, romanticized bite that somebody had received, you know, in a dark alleyway in Eastern Europe someplace, and then they become turned or something like that. You know, this really kind of, this whole vampire panic in New England, to me, is a very unsexy sort of way to describe the vampire issue or fear or scare or however you want to put it.
Yes. I was typing up this thing. I'm actually about to post this article on a Circle Way case from 2004 where people were prosecuted specifically, like killing someone because of a suspected vampire or Circle Way.
So I think the question that I have is, okay, so I get during this time people had tuberculosis, and it kind of mimicked these stories about a vampire, and okay, we think they're vampires, and that's what everybody's dying. Okay, I get that. But why are people today still believing in vampires?
From my perspective, it is deeply ingrained cultural and religious beliefs, number one. And number two, it's lack of evidence to scientific fact and, you know, recent reporting. I mean, it's a lack of evidence. Like how many people in rural Romania do you think have access to the internet? Probably less than San Antonio, Texas. Certainly. So I think that those people probably don't have the same levels of access to information that we do, and it's something that's just deeply, deeply ingrained in their culture and in their beliefs.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I understand. That definitely all makes sense.
Well, and I think, you know, there's some modern day stuff that's kind of creepy, and I just kind of share this with you guys. There was like a news article that I read that came across my, that I found in, yeah, I look at various news sites during the day just to keep up to date on current events. And there was a guy that was talking about how he's a real life vampire and he drinks blood and sleeps in a coffin. And it's just actually really strange. If we have a couple of minutes, I mean, could I share this article with you guys?
Yeah, that'd be great. Go ahead.
Okay, so this was posted. It's LAD Bible. I'm not really quite familiar with the site. It was just something that came up in the news. But it says, the title is Real Life Vampire Opens Up About Drinking Blood and Sleeping in a Coffin. October is here, and it's definitely not too early to start thinking about your Halloween costume. However, for one man, being spooky isn't a once-a-year thing, because Andreas Bathory, I think is how you would say his name, claims he is a real-life vampire who spends his days drinking blood, kipping in a coffin, and connecting with the souls of the dead. Romanian Andreas says that despite what you may have thought, vampires aren't just horror movie stuff. They're the real deal, and they walk among us. Rocking about the place, dressed all in black, obviously, Andreas lives on the grounds of Dracula's castle, a.k.a. Bran Castle, in Transylvania, and says that true vampirism shouldn't be confused with the more modern fetished idea of drinking blood. Andreas, who refuses to reveal his true age, goes on to say that the tradition he indulges in dates back over 600 years. quote, "I keep a distance from the modern online vampire community," quote, he said. Quote, "We preserve traditions that are more than 600 years old. The modern vampire community is full of sexual practices that work against the nature of existence of the higher self of the vampire. The vampire within doesn't fulfill itself through sexual deviance, blood fetishes, or BDSM. This is not the way of the vampire," end quote. So what is the way of the vampire then? Well, to Andreas, it involves drinking the blood of willing volunteers, whom he refers to as black swans, and spending time in a meditative state inside a coffin where he will connect with the souls of the dead. Sounds fun. Quote, "We feed from consensual donors only," he said. Quote, "You would be surprised by the number of people who freely offer themselves to you if you let them know you are a vampire. Believe it or not, I never asked. Few of us have to. People offer themselves to us of their own free will to understand vampires and our energy. There are health risks, but no different from crossing the street. We take measures to make sure the transaction is safe." Quote, then he adds, "Sometimes I sleep in a coffin when I want to be dead to the world and meditate." He is also the elected leader of the Ordo Dracul Coven, a group of like-minded folks who claim that the coven dates back to 1476. Andreas says his life changed a few years back when he was visited by Vlad Tepes, also known as Vlad the Impaler, and the real-life inspiration for Count Dracula. He explains, quote, "4 years ago, he came to me in my dreams. He was in a dark chamber calling me my son. I don't believe I'm his descendant, but that rather he chose me to relay his message and traditions with the new generation. After that night, I brought an offering to the place where he was killed, and he told me, 'Your life will change forever now.' It did. But not everyone," and that's the end quote, "but not everyone is on board with the whole real-life vampire thing, as Andreas found out when he decided to go public with his blood drinking. Of course, we deal with plenty of online haters," he said. "They are just jealous." Quote, "If somebody told me all of this a decade ago, it would seem like fantasy. But if you faced the forces that I have, you would understand." So, yeah, real life, you know, but notice it doesn't say anything about how they feed or, you know, I mean, I'm assuming drinking blood of willing volunteers, I'm thinking there's some sort of medical equipment involved. I mean, there's nothing, you know, revealed about him biting people or anything like that. So, but yeah, just kind of interesting way of life there.
Yeah. So
there's also a
Go ahead, Gary.
Okay. Yeah, there's also whole communities in New Orleans and in Louisiana that are considered vampire communities where people do indulge in drinking the blood. And I actually saw this on an episode of Dark Tourist, and you guys should check it out if you haven't yet. It's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool series. But anyway, they talk about these covens, I guess you could call them. I mean, I guess they wouldn't be covens, these communities, and how exactly they go about doing it, including the medical supplies needed and then all the testing that's involved and all of that. So there are people right here in the U.S. that do the same thing.
Okay. Again, I get all that part. But Vlad himself, coming to him in a dream and is he immortal? And
I don't,
also is his given last name Bathory, or did he pick that one out himself?
I don't know. The article doesn't say. And like it said also in the article, he would not reveal his true age. So I mean, I don't know.
I think it's probably a choice.
Okay.
I mean, I would have to say that man probably did not naturally come by that, so. And even Vlad appearing to him in a dream, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to do with my
dream?
Hands.
Totally.
Yeah, like, cool, that's that don't base your whole life on maybe that. Maybe he obviously has access to the internet. He obviously has access to information. So it's, that's a lot. It's a lot to unpack there.
It is a lot to unpack, but you know what, though? I have to think of that. Sometimes I have to, there's part of me that looks at these things with, you know, yes, it's a choice, and, you know, there's obviously some sort of, you know, influence there of some kind to make that choice. But, you know, I mean, think about the topics that we talk about on this show. I mean, who's to say that he did not have this experience, though? I mean, you know, he could have. I mean, nobody would, we would never know that.
I mean, yeah, he could have, but I don't know. I have a lot of crazy dreams, too, but I'm, you know, like, reality has to take a seat at some point, you know?
Yeah, it just seems like you said there's a lot there, and I would think that you would have to go through something really extreme to change your lifestyle like that. That there would have to be some sort of major thing that happens to you, whether it be a dream or a vision or something. And it's almost like liking it to somebody who is very non-religious. You know, maybe atheist that has an experience in their life that turns them to Christ.
Yeah. You just compared that to vampirism. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page. I mean, I feel that way. However, I certainly feel that way. And I mean, like think about it, right? So, what's his name? Jim Jones. You know, Jim Jones had Jesus approach in a dream, and he told him to make this community in Ghana, and all these things happened. And, you know, probably just maybe take the meat, like take something from the dream, but don't like change your whole life for the dream. Like, no, that's dangerous.
Definitely don't change your whole life based on a dream if the changes you make involve harming other people. That's pointed at Jim Jones, not at Mr. Bathory.
Yep.
Yeah, that's probably good advice. Probably definitely good advice.
we have about 7 minutes left. Are we ready for our creepy pasta?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. All right.
Lay it on me.
Genetic memory. Many classic horror icons, such as Geiger's xenomorph, Silent Hill's Pyramid Head, and other disturbing creatures share common characteristics. Pale skin, dark, sunken eyes, and elongated faces. Sharp teeth and the like. These images inspire horror and revulsion in many, and with good reason. The characteristics shared by these faces are imprinted in the human mind. Many things frighten humans instinctively. The fear is natural and does not need to be reinforced in order to terrify. The fears are species-wide, stemming from dark times in the past when lightning could mean the burning of your tree home, thunder could mean the approaching gallops of a stampede, predators could hide in the darkness, and heights could make poor footing lethal. The question you have to ask yourself is this: what happened deep in the hidden eras before history began that could affect the entire human race so evenly as to give the entire species a deep, instinctual, and lasting fear of pale beings with dark, sunken eyes, razor-sharp teeth, and elongated faces? Be careful out there. Oh, that's a lot of food for thought there.
Spooky.
Spooky.
I'm going with aliens on this one. Elongated faces, sunken eyes, pale beings, you know, the grays. I'm going with aliens on this one.
Could be. We don't know.
You know what?
We don't know. Could be. Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
With my aversion to aliens, I'm going to go with, like, some nice, good, I'm going to go, like, a bear with, like, mange, so it doesn't have any fur, and that.
Mange.
That's what I'm going with. Just a bear.
No,
just a bear.
I'm going vampires. I'm going vampires. Or zombies.
You're going vampires.
I'm going vampires or zombies.
And there, folks, you have the wide range of opinions on freaks and geeks.
Yep. That's why you listen to Freaks and Geeks, because we can do these sorts of things. All right. Well, I guess with that all said, we can go ahead and close out for the week. We will see you guys back next week for Ouija/divination boards, and we can't wait to see you again.
See you next week.